You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 19th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live. In the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dow Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Professor Juan Cole of Informed Comment will be talking with us about India's election, which is brought a far-right Hindu nationalist who may have been complicit in mass murder, certainly was complicit in mass murder to at least some degree, of Muslims during his reign as governor of Gujarat. We're going to talk about that election, what led to it, and what comes next. Also touch on the story that Sam covered briefly last week, the neoliberal dimension of the mining disaster in Turkey. We also have a lot more for you, such as...
We have stories about... Well, first of all, we have this hilarious story about a certain right-wing outlet who saw a study on climate change and decided to, take it for their own little spin.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. They're covering climate change. Fascinating.
Yeah. I guess we should give them props for that.
Probably not.
Yeah, probably not, yeah. But...
We'll see how it happens. Also, Dick Cheney demands accountability for Hillary Clinton because...
Benghazi!
And it happened on her watch. I wonder about all the things that happened on Dick Cheney's watch. Yeah, well, he was obviously held really accountable. That's why he's on TV pontificating about Hillary Clinton.
I'm sure he has a very nice watch, actually. I'm sure he has many very nice watches.
Right. Absolutely. Peggy Noonan shares some new delusion. Fun to check in on her fantasy life at times.
Republican in Utah would like to see the firing squad make a comeback.
Ah, interesting reaction to that horrific... botched execution a couple of weeks ago. Let's get the firing squad going. Obviously, also your calls and IMs. We're going to get to a lot in the fun half, but we're going to take a brief break right now and come right back with Professor Juan Cole. Thanks for being with us. Matt is actually saying that...
Give me a second so we can pull up this great music that Michael has prepared for us. And here we go.
All right, we'll be right back, folks.
The beginning and end. As far as rap go, it's only natural. I explain my plateau and also what defines my name. First it was nasty, but times have changed. Actually now I'm the artist, but hardcore my signs for pain. I spent time in the game, kept my mind on fame. Saw things shoot up and do lines of saw my close friend shot, flatlining my same. That depends, carry MAC-10s to practice my aim. On rooftops, tape CD covers the trees. Line a barrel up with your weak pinching and squeeze. Street scriptures for lost souls in the crossroads. To the corner thugs hustling for cars that cost dough. To the big dogs living large, taking it light. Pushing big toys, getting nice, join your life is what you make it. Suicide, few tried to take it. Belt tied around their neck and jail cells naked. Heaven and hell, rap legend, presence is felt. And of course, NAS are the letters that spell. Not psych, life or death. I'm a rebel. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not psych, not psych. Half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not psych, life or death. I'm a rebel. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not psych, not psych. Half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not just like not
earth, wind, and fire. Rims and tires. Bulletproof glass inside is the realest driver. Planets in orbit. Line them up with the stars, tarot cards, you can see the Pharaoh Nas. Iron Mike, Messiah type, before the Christ, after the death, the last one left.
Let my cash invest in stock. Came a long way from blasting. Techs on blocks. Went from Seiko to Rolex. Owning acres from the projects with no chips to large cake though. Dimes giving
back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks, sorry about that, folks. There was some hinky technical issues, which there is no need to get into. But I'm very, very happy to welcome now Professor Juan Cole at the University of Michigan. He's also the proprietor of the indispensable blog Informed Comment. How are you, Professor?
Great. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much for joining us. So there was major elections in India over the weekend, and I guess there's always an Indian election is always a major election in some respects, I guess, because by definition, it being the world's largest democracy, it's always a kind of complex operation every time there's an election there. And basically, before we dig into some of the kind of broader aspects of what happened, I think the main takeaway is that we're going to see an Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who represents the Hindu far right. And not only does he represent that politically, he's actually, at the very least, complicit in some very serious charges of communal violence in his previous political incarnation as essentially the governor of the state of Gujarat. So I'm wondering if you could explain that incident, and then we'll get into the kind of broader dynamics of what happened.
Well, Hindu nationalism has been an important strain of Indian nationalism all along, and in fact it was the RSS, an extremist Hindu organization that was implicated in the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi in the late 40s. So, and that's an organization, I personally would, you know, compare it to the Ku Klux Klan, to which Modi belonged in his youth. And he then joined the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is kind of the civil political manifestation of Hindu nationalist impulses. And he rose to become governor of Gujarat. In 2002, there were riots, and there was a pogrom, really, against Muslims in Gujarat. And, you know, there were questions raised as to whether the state government responded swiftly enough or whether the whole rhetoric around Hindu nationalism had encouraged the miscreants to commit the pogrom in the first place. There were Indian government commissions that did absolve Modi of direct involvement in those pogroms. But he was viewed as having been, let us say, insufficiently opposed to them the time, and therefore was put on a list of people not welcome to visit the United States, for instance.
Right. And I mean, and I think part of that reason actually is that there were some Christians who were also caught up in that violence as well, which is part of the political dynamic of not welcoming him here. So we get that he has this very extreme background. There's a very questionable, at the very least, and I think it maybe should also be added that not only was he maybe insufficiently, if we're going to, again, going with the most mild interpretation, insufficiently sort of ready to intervene in the violence, he also didn't exactly, you know, he didn't use conciliatory rhetoric in subsequent elections or kind of make an effort to sort of soothe the wounds of those events. He kind of maintained his, you know, his pretty strong, sharp social and religious stance essentially moving forward. The other aspect of Modi, and I think the one that's getting a lot of traction in the Western press and is an interesting kind of fusion of the BJP, is that there's this Hindu nationalism, and then there's basically very market-oriented neoliberal economic policies, and that's another aspect of what he campaigned on, and that's kind of the aspect that is being presented to the West right now. How do those two dynamics come together?
Well, both are opposed to the ruling, the Congress Party, which had ruled India for much of the period since independence. Congress in its platform, describes itself as a secular and tolerant party and as a socialist party. And Congress, frankly, didn't do a very good job with the economy until the 1980s. There was a 3% population growth and 3% economic growth. So if you divide the two, it means the per capita increase in income was zero all the way from the end of World War II until the early 80s. Economists kind of joke that it was the Hindu rate of growth.
Yeah.
And and then in the early 80s, the Congress started, you know, they had unreasonable restrictions on foreign currency transactions. And I remember I was in India in the early 80s, and I wanted to send a package abroad. And I had to go around to government offices getting stamps that it would be all right to send this package overseas. So it was really inefficient. And the whole Congress system, which dominated government for so long, locked out a lot of people. So I would argue that kind of there was a lower middle class not tied to the Congress government elite, which was resentful of kind of being left out. And for them, the combination of an emphasis on a Hindu identity rather than this namby-pamby Congress tolerance business, and then also an emphasis on entrepreneurial activity and opening up the economy, those two things went together as a way of challenging the socialist Congress hegemony.
So, okay, so I want to actually get deeper into that contrast, because the other aspect of the Congress party that seemed to, well, I mean, number one, there were persistent corruption scandals and mismanagement that did occur. The Congress has been governing since 2004 when they came back to power after another BJP government was actually briefly in place. The other aspect is that there's a dynastic component to the Congress party. You know, Nehru, obviously, great independence leader, governed the country. Then his daughter, Indira. And now Rahul Gandhi, the grandson, was campaigning. And Sonia Gandhi, the daughter-in-law of Indira, is essentially the head of the party. And then, you know, Modi made a sort of great campaign style of being working his way up as a tea seller, essentially. So those things were very, I mean, the cultural aspect of that, the cultural politics of that, were very much at the forefront.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. There's, well, as I was trying to indicate, you know, yeah, the Congress was an elite. And although it said it was socialist, right, it was very paternalistic kind of socialism. It was the elite taking care of the lower classes. And yeah, the dynastic element is there, and some people are wondering whether, you know, the charm of that family has declined. I just think that any party that rules for a really long time starts to run into these kinds of problems of corruption and image and so forth. And then it didn't help so much that, you know, Sonia Gandhi, the head of the party, is in fact from Italy. And so the BJP used that against them. But the big thing that happened here, I think, is that the Congress party policies were trying to keep the economy growing at a high rate. Mm-hmm. They had some success in the last decade of, you know, 7 and 8% growth some years, but it had fallen to more like 4. They were trying to stimulate that because Manmohan Singh, the prime minister in Congress, who's an economist, believes that in order to, you know, do what China did, to really get ahead in, as a country, you have to get 5% growth, economic growth, above your population growth. So if you've got 3% population growth, you've got to do 8% in order to start putting money in people's pockets on a per capita basis. So, but they overheated things. So you had, you know, 8-9% inflation, and inflation is a tax on the middle class and the poor. You know, you go to the market and bread is more expensive than it was, and all your staples and your fuel and everything was more. So this inflationary element in Congress economic policy of the last few years I think, really turned people off to them, and it was across the board, and it's one of the reasons for the landslide.
Was Modi campaigning? I understand kind of unleashing entrepreneurship, but was he talking about a more austerity oriented set of policies? What was his kind of broader economic message, or was he keeping it simple and just saying, in contrast to the kind of paternalistic plus high inflation, I'm gonna just sort of allow the middle class to unleash itself more? Was that essentially his message?
Yes, the latter. I mean, yeah. You know, to be fair, Modi has walked the walk economically. Mm-hmm. So Gujarat state is doing very well. And he attracted a lot of foreign investment, and he's put a lot of people to work. And he's got his slogan, you know, really was about economic innovation.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting thing because, you know, on the one hand, you've got this emphasis on Hindu nationalism and kind of Indian authenticity. And these guys, you know, don't even believe that Indo-European languages were brought into India from northern invasions, as archaeologists believe. They think that, you know, Sanskrit was invented in India 5,000 years ago. And
right.
So they're very nativist.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they've got this discourse of technological innovation. They're not afraid of technology, and they celebrate it. And so Modi, you know, is famous for promoting solar energy in Gujarat. And you know, you always have the problem in urban areas of where exactly would you put all those panels because they're big. And in India, they irrigate, and the irrigation canals suffer from high rates of evaporation because of the subtropical climate. So he put the solar panels over top the irrigation canals.
Hmm.
And killed two birds with one stone. He cut down on the evaporation of the water, plus then he had a place to generate the solar power. So, you know, that's the kind of image he wants to project, is authentic and yet hyper-modern.
Yeah, I mean, so before I think we need to get more to that, because that's going to be essential to how he will actually govern as a national leader, and also the relationship that stands now between the BJP and the RSS. But you know, that record in Gujarat, I understand that there was good economic performance to a degree. He did walk the walk, as you say, but in this very kind of market-oriented deregulatory approach, in contrast to the maybe the more social democratic approach of Congress, I mean, what obviously in a situation like in India, a certain degree of just broad-based economic growth is going to affect everybody and bring up certain living standards. But by that same token, I mean, what was the approach pursued by him in Gujarat, though? Did it enhance inequality? Was it, you know, I've heard accusations like the writer Pankaj Mishra has said, you know, it's very crony capitalistic. There was a lot of, you know, there wasn't a kind of integrated sense of social programs or other factors integrated. It was this kind of blunt sort of market oriented instrument. So was the growth, did it produce those kind of ancillary problems, or should he really get more credit than that, at least in terms of economic performance?
The problem with neoliberal policies is that I think they actually can jumpstart the economy and create a lot of jobs and improve people's standard of living,
yeah,
if they're done right.
Right.
If they're done wrong, then you get Argentina. But, you know, there's always a plateau that you reach in any new set of economic programs, whether they're neoliberal or socialist. You know, if they're done right, you can jumpstart the economy. You can maybe double people's incomes, and people are very grateful for that, obviously. But then you run into a plateau for various reasons, and you know, the neoliberal policies do run into this plateau. Eventually of concentration of wealth at the top, and as you say, crony capitalism. And but again, you know, despite the increase in inequality and so forth, you couldn't deny that a lot of people are better off 10
right.
years later
right.
in Gujarat. And that's what matters when people go to the ballot box. But sure, you know, Modi is not going to be worker friendly in a policy sort of way. even if some of what he does may increase economic growth. And India, you know, has such enormous economic potential that it is possible. And Manmohan Singh did this, as I said, as finance minister and then as prime minister. He managed to jumpstart a significant growth. And there are some critics who would say that Congress had turned to more or less neoliberal policies in the 90s and zeros, so that on that scale, there isn't very much any longer to choose between the two.
Absolutely. So as a final question before we move to Turkey briefly, I mean, you know, so you mentioned Modi's background in this RSS group, now obviously the leader of the BJP, leader of India. And given the history in India, I mean, not just the pogrom in Gujarat, but there was mass killings of Sikhs in the 1980s, obviously partition, there was a tremendous amount of violence and killing. I mean, what is the relationship now between the BJP as a party and a group like the RSS, which you say is like a clan-like organization? And, you know, sure, Modi had campaigned essentially on an economic message, but obviously this history and this context still stands. I mean, what do you see happening from a kind of communal and pluralistic point of view and perspective over the next couple of years?
Well, you know, there are two possibilities. One is that having come to power in such a dramatic way and across the country, really, that the BJP will moderate and become more pragmatic. And if that happens, it will be all to the good. And, you know, Muslims are something like 12% of the Indian population, and the Congress always tried to get them as a voting bloc. If BJP knows what it's good for it, it will try to cultivate them as a constituency now that it's a national party. That's one possibility, is that coming to power will moderate them. You think about in the United States, you know, Reagan as a Republican insurgent against Ford in the 70s, once he becomes president, you know, nowadays a lot of conservatives see Reagan as having been way too liberal. So you could see that kind of thing happen, or the constant drumbeat of anti-Muslim sentiment, and as you say, there have been also concerns about Christian missionaries in some parts of the country that have resulted in violence. That this kind of extreme wounded nationalism that lashes out at minorities, that the prevalence of that kind of rhetoric in power, you know, could result in some more pogroms. So we don't know. I mean, you know, the right wing of the Hindu nationalism wants to tear down the Taj Mahal. They view us Muslims in India who have, you know, Muslims have been in India since the 9th century. They view them as foreign, as a kind of illegal immigrants or something. And they're, of course, Indians who converted. And the fact is that most of India had been Buddhist until around that time, so that the rise of modern Hinduism and the rise of modern Islam are almost co-equal in India. But the Hindus want to claim, you know, India has always been Hindu. It's 5,000 years of Sanskrit, and these Muslims have shown up from overseas. And so they want to delegitimize them and then erase the heritage of the Mughal Empire and of Islam in India. So if that kind of rhetoric gets too heated, you know, it can result in attacks on individual Muslims and on communities. So I think we have to see how it works out. I'm hoping that they'll take the pragmatic road.
Right. And then there's also, I mean, for another conversation would be the foreign policy dimension of how, you know, this type of politics affects relations with particularly China and Pakistan, obviously. But moving, I want to go to Turkey for a moment. Last summer, actually, I believe we spoke about the Gezi Park protests and how a kind of underappreciated aspect of the controversies surrounding Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey was, in fact, his strong, extreme neoliberalism in some respects. And it seems to me that as Erdogan has gotten more and more volatile as a personality and as a leader, and this mining disaster that you know it's bringing some things into making some things quite clear, it seems to me. And I would love to your perspective on why. What was the particular role of the neoliberalism privatization aspects of this mining disaster? And is there a possibility that the response to this from the prime minister, as well as the context surrounding it, could lead to maybe a broader disillusionment with his governance than previous things we have seen?
Yeah, well, there's not a really good sign in the polling that Erdogan has suffered among his power base, and that's what's important since it seems to be a majority of the country. So Tayyip Erdogan has Muslim fundamentalist tendencies, although he, you know, was in jail for them because Turkey mandated secularism and the generals used to persecute Muslim activists. And so he adopted this rhetoric of kind of pluralism or multiculturalism, in which he tried to make a place in secular Turkey for observant Muslims. You know, women with headscarves weren't allowed on government property and university campuses. And his whole program from one side was about a kind of multiculturalism. And on the other, again, he emphasized against the old state run by the generals and the secular elite. He emphasized privatization of the public sector, which was quite large in Turkey, and had, again, you know, in the past 10 years, an enormous success with those policies. His government vastly increased trade, they increased foreign investment, indisputably people in the small towns of Turkey are better off than they had been because of this increase in economic efflorescence. And however, you know, the generals had destroyed the unions, and so the working class organization is very weak. And there's a lot of corruption. Some people think that there's a bubble-like aspect to some of this efflorescence. And this mine in Soma appears to have been, you know, privatized as part of the privatization program and then not properly inspected. So when Erdogan went there and there had been this fire and people died, hundreds died from carbon monoxide poisoning, probably, you know, it was implicated in neoliberal policies that less regulation, more privatization, et cetera. And so Erdogan was, as the cheerleader for those policies, was on the defensive. And he went there and he said, well, yes, this is a horrible tragedy, but, you know, these things happened in Victorian England when it was taking off in the 19th century. And,
right.
He actually instanced several, you know, mining disasters in Victorian England. And I think people didn't understand why, but from my point of view, it's very clear. You know, Victorian England was that transition in the 19th century of Britain from being an agrarian to an industrial society. And, you know, the British economy just multiplied many times over in that period and became, Britain became a new kind of economic colossus in the world because of this. So in Erdogan's mind, you know, he's Palmerston or something. Mm-hmm. He's at the helm of this magnificent transformation of Turkey into a world power and a capitalist giant. So he was kind of saying, well, you know, there are costs to that, and this is one of them. And the people whose loved ones had died in the mines were furious at him. They attacked him. He had to run away to a grocery store, and there was a crowd in there, and he had to slap some guy to get away from him. And he may have slapped two people. I think one of them was a woman. Well, there, you know, it's a fog of war. You can't really tell. But then there was one
the
of his
fog of Erdogan
got caught on. Yeah, Erdogan. So one of Erdogan's aides got caught on camera kicking a protester and a mourner, you know. So,
yeah.
So the message from Erdogan was, you know, to the workers' families was, you know, suck it up. This is the price of progress. And
you're expendable in that process. I'm sorry, go ahead. But I mean, I think it was even more brutal than that, really. It's, you know, you're a statistic for this broader project, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. I mean, people were outraged, and there have been protests. There had been protests against Erdogan's policies last summer by kind of engaged youth, because, you know, Erdogan never saw a mall he didn't like, and his government has been kind of putting them everywhere. You know, what are these useless trees doing here when there could be a mall? And so consumerism and privatization, deregulation. And Islam, you know, all those things go together in Erdogan's mind. So, you know, your juxtaposition of India and Turkey in this program is quite canny, because I think, you know, some similar keynotes are being hit here.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that, right. These are these formulas we're seeing kind of emerge in these contexts, and they've been around for a while, but obviously we're quite familiar with it in the United States, the fusion of a strong religiosity and cultural politics with a devotion to kind of unencumbered market policies. But I guess the final question on Erdogan, though, is that it seems to me that in some respects the process with him has been, you know, I you know, when he first came to power, there was certainly the notion that because again, we, you know, always, every time there's a discussion of Turkey, it's very important, I think, to note that in the first couple of years of this government, they made more progress in terms of Turkey getting closer to joining the EU than previous secular Turkish governments. They really did impose some genuine reforms in human rights and other areas in Turkey that were significant, not to mention some real success in terms of the Kurdish question, which is always significant in Turkey. But it just seems to me that, you know, there's a language in some of the literature that of discoursing democracy versus internalizing democracy. And it seems that with Erdogan that, you know, democracy is the thing that's going to go. Religiosity and markets are there to stay, but democracy seems it's expendable, or at least anything beyond elections. Is that fair? Or,
Well, I think, you know, the conception of democracy, because Erdogan keeps winning these elections with a large margin, and has gotten to the point now where he thinks democracy is winning an election,
right,
which, you know, some political scientists would call elective dictatorship. That once the people have gone to the ballot box and elected a government, then they should sit down and be quiet, and the government should do whatever it likes. I mean, we saw a lot of that in the Bush-Cheney years,
right,
here. And so he believes in a kind of elective dictatorship, and he's displayed this belief more and more fervently as time has gone on, and as he has faced challenges even from the religious right. So the religious right in Turkey is split in two groups, and they're the Erdogan people, and then there's a kind of corporate almost group, the Gulenjis, the followers of Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania, and who are kind of Muslim modernists and joined with Erdogan initially, but they've developed a feud with him, and since they were inside his government, they had access to a lot of secrets about corruption that they have been revealing in the past few months. And Erdogan has become, therefore, more and more defensive, being attacked both from the secular center and left, and from the religious right. But he like Modi to some extent, despite an increasing rhetoric of intolerance. He has been at the helm over 10 years of genuine economic expansion that has actually improved people's standard of living in the small towns and cities of the center, and is therefore enormously popular.
It's the economy, stupid. Professor, yeah. Professor Cole, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate having you on.
It's so great being here. Thanks so much.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, folks, again, sorry about the technical mishaps before, but that was good conversation.
We all know that the right wing and conservative media outlets are doing everything they can to either just flat out ignore climate change or to try to make their readers, viewers, whatever, just believe they shouldn't really care about it. It's not a big deal. But one right-wing media outlet says to themselves, you know, maybe we can't ignore this. Maybe we can't try to convince people to ignore it. So let's cover it. Sounds shocking, right? I mean,
wow!
Doesn't seem like something that would be so uncalled for, especially when, you know, climate change is probably the most prevalent issue of our time. But this media outlet, The Daily Caller, who you might know as the media outlet, it's the right wing website that's run by Tucker Carlson, and here on this show we know it most for it employing our dear friend Patrick Howley.
10 reasons why climate change is good for the babes. Yeah, by Patrick Howley.
That's
whoa.
Really why. Number one, girls will be wearing bikinis.
Yeah, exactly.
Number one.
Two extra months of bikini season.
Yeah. Number two, the same as number one. But anyway.
You should give yourself a shofar for that one.
Let's give you a shofar for that one.
I think that is like your funniest one.
Thank you. No, but if they're not going to use climate change to prove why it's okay to ogle women, they're going to use climate change to try to spin it to generate news they want to hear. And that is, climate change is good.
Uh-huh.
A study recently came out, and the Daily Caller covered it with the following title. Global warming is increasing biodiversity around the world. Well, that sounds great. A new study, Michael Bastash of Daily Caller writes, published in the journal Science, has astounded biologists. Global warming is not harming biodiversity, but instead is increasing the range and diversity of species in various ecosystems. Environmentalists, have long warned that global warming could lead to mass extinctions as fragile ecosystems around the world are made unlivable as temperatures increase. But a team of biologists from the United States, UK, and Japan have found that global warming has not led to a decrease in biodiversity. Instead, biodiversity has increased in many areas on land and in the ocean. Doesn't that sound swell?
Dude, more places for, like, chicks to swim. Like, more.
Woo! Well, Media Matters decided to contact the scientist responsible for the study, the lead author. Dr. Maria Dornalis from the Center of Biological Diversity responded in a statement to Media Matters. And this is what she says. No, our study shows nothing of the kind. It is a complete distortion of what we say, and I had no idea this story was running. She continues, what we do show is that despite indisputable loss of biodiversity at the scale of the planet, in most places we detect a change in species that live there rather than loss of species everywhere. We suggest that part of this is caused by species migrating towards the poles in response to climate change, and part to invasive species replacing local species. There is nothing in our papers to even suggest that climate change is beneficial for biodiversity. She even gave an example of how this could play out. Imagine three islands. One has bluebirds, one has green birds, and one has yellow birds. Bluebird Island gets warmer, and these imaginary bluebirds are sensitive to the climate variation, so they go extinct. But their island is now suitable for the green birds, so the green birds colonize it. So now the green birds have two islands, their Greenbird Island and the Bluebird Island. But then, when Greenbird Island stays the same, Greenbirds would also be introduced to Yellowbird Island. And Yellowbirds could not fight the competition and go extinct. At the end, we have the same number of species on each island. There are birds on all three islands, like there were birds in all three islands before. But the species that live there are different. And in total, we have lost two-thirds of the species.
Just want to say really briefly, the Daily Caller did something that is really smart, though, journalistically. It's brilliant. It's such a good idea when you report on the conclusions of a scientific study. Never call up the people that conducted the study and get a quote from them or confirm what you're writing.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, like, to do that is just so lame.
Yeah.
It's not like cutting edge, ballsy journalism.
Well, going back to what the Daily Caller's article says,
it's liberal.
They point out that their version of what the study says. The study says species turnover was above expected, but do not find evidence of systematic biodiversity loss. The editor's abstract adds that the result could be caused by homogenization of species, assemblages by invasive species, shifting distributions induced by climate change, and change across the planet. Wow, that seems like exactly what she said, except they're somehow pulling out a positive out of it. I mean, Media Matters got even more statements from the people involved in this study. A corresponding perspective paper on the biodiversity study in Science, Dr. John Pandolfi, he authored the perspective paper, said that it's a gross distortion and directly contradicts the main message of the paper. In an email to Media Matters, the National Wildlife Federation's Bruce Stein explained how an increased rate of foreign species invasion could destroy the integrity of ecosystems. And I want to end on his quote, because I don't know if he realized what he was saying. I think he does. But it really does point out the crossover in the worlds. So as to why Republicans use this, he says, saying that global warming is increasing biodiversity ignores basic ecology, by confusing ecological desirable native species with the invasion of non-natives that are enriching the diversity of our ecosystems, even as they destroy their integrity. That's like saying that our economy would be in better shape if only we had a bigger labor force, even if most of those jobs were at or below the minimum wage.
They're like, we would say
that. Yes, we would say that. Exactly. This guy is a great point.
This guy's totally on.
He's on point.
You know what would be awesome is if there was a bunch of species extinction and then, like, people working at 30 cents an hour to dig coal out of the last remaining mines on Earth.
What I really do want, though, really badly, please, someone, if you're out there listening to this and you know Patrick Halley, maybe, get him to write that article. Get him to write that
10
article.
10 reasons why climate change is good for the babes.
And then he'll...
Hard on the crops, easy on the eyes.
and then a month later, he'll come out with the main reason why climate change is no good. And everyone will be like, oh shit, he finally realizes that climate change is no good. The main reason why climate change is no good is because I have a girlfriend now, and she's wearing a bikini, and everybody else is looking at her. You remember that article, right, where he complained about CPAC because everyone was hitting on his girlfriend?
I don't, but I will go to CPAC and hit on Patrick Kelly's girlfriend in front of him, too. I'll be there. We're going to head – I think we should head to the fun half.
We can head to the fun half if that's what you would like, Michael.
Would you like to not head to the fun half?
We can head to the fun half if that's what you would like.
That doesn't sound very fun.
If you'd like to head to the fun half, Michael, we can head to the fun half.
Okay, let's head to the fun half. Folks.
No, we should head to the fun half.
We should head to the fun half. We have many great stories coming at you in the fun half, such as,
well, I don't know if they're all so much fun.
Yeah, but, yeah. I think we have to cop to having a Sam Cedar-esque fun half in some respects.
All right, but here's a fun story. Yeah. Some Republican news outlets, not Republican, right-wing news outlets – are starting to jump aboard this talking about climate change train.
Ah.
Even if they are getting it completely 100% undeniably wrong.
Okay. Well, that sounds about like what you'd expect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We also have a story about the poorest county in all of America and how they view the current political atmosphere, I guess you can say.
Uh-huh.
It will be shocking to you. And a fun story about how Americans totally support the death. Well, not totally. That's wrong. I was getting a little bit too much on my
strongly support.
My promoter Matt was coming out there. But
that sounds like a new character.
Promoter Matt.
I liked how film guy Matthew pointed out that sometimes when you're getting really like when you're laying it on, the WWE voice comes out.
Wrestling promoter Matt was right
that
there.
That sounds like wrestling promoter
Matt.
Let
me tell you something, folks.
Yeah.
You got to believe that the death penalty is stronger than ever. What you going to do when executions go run wild on you?
Wow.
No, but really, it's disgusting.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. Also, Dick Cheney wants Hillary Clinton held accountable for Benghazi. And a little sound clip from our old friend Peggy Noonan.
The Noonster.
And also our other old friend, Peggy Noonan's mind. What's happening inside her head. There's Peggy Noonan, and then there's Peggy Noonan's fantasy life. They're a package, but they're somewhat discreet entities, and we'll get to that. Folks, become a member today. It's an easy, simple, and actually really gratifying thing to do. A lot of people, when they write in and they've said, hey, I finally become a member, they express a lot of happiness in doing it. It feels good. There's big emotional payoff to becoming a member. So go to majority.fm.
Majority.fm.
Click on become a member. It'll take you less than 5 minutes.
It'll take you less than 5 minutes.
You can email us at majorityreporters.
If you don't want to use PayPal, you can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com.
I'll give you an address. You can mail a check.
You an address so you can mail a check.
What else? I'll repeat you now.
You can subscribe to us at YouTube at youtube.com/SamCedar. We put some great stuff up there. There's some YouTube exclusives every now and then. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/majorityreport. You can follow us on Twitter at majorityfm. You can buy fair trade coffee at justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. And you can put in coupon code majority and you get 10% off your order.
Triple win.
And then for an additional cherry on top, you can go to majorityapp.com and download the app if you haven't already. And if you have downloaded that app, then share the love with all of your friends and family members and tell them to go to majorityapp.com and download the app.
Indeed.
And even further, you can buy all your Amazon stuff through our Amazon affiliate page. You will notice no difference whatsoever in your prices, in your order, in your anything. All that happens is that Amazon will say, hey, look, they bought it through the Majority Report page. We got to give them a small kickback so they continue to do so.
That's it.
And to do that, you go to majorityreportkickback.com.
And
you know what? Convince people who don't even listen to the show. I'm sure you have friends and family members who don't listen to the show, and you've been telling them to listen, I know, but they just say we don't have the time, or we're busy, or whatever. And while those are lame excuses, and I'm sure you're still fighting them on that front, the least they can do is buy their stuff through our Amazon link so they can support what to them is, I guess, a faceless name.
What to them is excellent independent media that they choose not to partake in for whatever lame reason. They're too busy watching The View or something. You can join the program.
That's one way to get people to start listening, actually. Yeah. Oh, you don't listen to the show? You listen to The View, I'm assuming? Oh, that's right. You better start listening to the majority.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just assume you're watching Jenny McCarthy talk about vaccinations. If you're not listening to us, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I am firing that up right now. We will see you in the better half of the program.
Take care, freebies. Sam's back tomorrow. Members, see you in a minute.
Peace.